Well, thank you very much for having me here this afternoon. Sorry, my gizmo seems to be falling off. I hope that's all right for people at the back now. Thank you for that kind introduction. Perhaps I should start by saying that, you know, as I think about macroeconomics, well, it's not always clear what the distinction between macroeconomics and microeconomics is. There are some things which we might say macroeconomics is almost certainly not about, the way in which people choose to spend their money on food rather than on clothing. No one would say that's a macroeconomic issue. But as far as I can see, there are two key marginal decisions which could be seen as macroeconomic as well as microeconomic decisions. One is the choice between work and leisure and the way that people respond to incentives. And the other is the intertemporal choice between consumption today and consumption tomorrow, or equivalently, the choice between consumption and saving. Now, if one, I'm not making observations about the recent government, but if you think back over the span, I suppose, of my political memory, we have heard quite a lot about policies being needed to achieve an appropriate incentive, an appropriate balance between work and leisure. And we heard various governments talking about how important it was to raise the activity rate among various categories of the population and so on. If you think back over the last 25 or 30 years, what you will also remember is that there has been effectively a gaping hole in terms of any national discussion about how much we should be consuming today relative to consuming tomorrow. We have had discussion about some things that are closely related. Perhaps the most obvious one is sustainability. But sustainability has typically been a concept that has been, captured by the green agenda and focused on preserving particular types of asset. I'm certainly not saying that that's unimportant, let alone irrelevant, but it's been focused on preserving particular types of asset, and we don't have any broad economic framework, or at least not one which is widely used, for thinking about sustainability in a more general sense. Well, what might I want to mean by an economy run on a sustainable basis? And I suppose I thought of something which, on the one hand, might sound informative, on the other hand, you might complain is vacuous. That a sustainably managed economy is one where people in the future are unlikely to be disappointed by the levels of consumption that they can enjoy. If we were to spend all our assets today, then people in the future would undoubtedly be disappointed. Well, you could say, why not go the other way round? Save absolutely everything so that people in the future might enjoy some sort of wonderful bonanza and we would starve. I'm not saying that that's a good idea either, but I think it's fair to say that most of the concern that we have, and I think with good reason, is not that we're under-consuming at the moment, although you can make an argument to that effect, but most of the concern is not that we're under-consuming at the moment, but that we're over-consuming. And over-consuming, is a concept that would encompass a wide range of sins. One is things like living on credit. Well, maybe that's less fashionable than it was a few years ago. Another would be a high level of carbon emissions and not doing anything about meeting the costs of dealing with the impact of those carbon emissions. So the idea of adequate saving is really a rather broad one, and at its broadest would incorporate both the issue of how we pay for our retirements and what sort of a world we're leaving for future generations. Well, no, the title is perhaps a bit back to front. It seems to me fairly clear that it's the amount that the nation saves which dictates the size of the pot that you have to provide for the future, whether that providing for the future is an adequate pension for people who are retiring, or whether that providing for the future is, as is appropriate, paying the costs of not having carbon emissions or saving up to deal with the consequences of carbon emissions. And I don't want to get into the debate about which of those is a better idea. But national saving is the mechanism by which one can do that. As I've argued, national saving is partly to do with provision of resources to people alive today relative to provision of resources to those alive in the future. But it's also something to do with fiscal policy. Well, what is the connection between national saving and fiscal policy? I mean, you might say not very much. We, again, for quite a long time have heard the argument that fiscal policy should be run with the aim in some form of balancing the government current account or balancing the budget or something like that. What's that to do with national saving? Well, stand back from that and think about the structure of the economy. National saving is the consequence of the saving that the individual agents in the economy do. Who can be saving in the economy? Well, it can be the private sector. That's partly households, people like us who can save out of our incomes. It's partly businesses which can save their profits, or they can distribute them to households which might choose whether they save them or go out and spend them. Or the third player in the game is the government. The government could, if it wanted to, save on our behalf, just as in the past, for good reason, it's been doing quite a lot of borrowing on our behalf. But if one thinks of those three players, which for convenience I'd like to reduce to two players, the government and the private sector, then if we're to concern ourselves with national saving, an obvious question for a policymaker to ask is the private sector saving enough? And if the conclusion to that is, no, you don't think they are, then the question is, should the government do something about it, and, or perhaps could it do something about it, before you get round to asking, should the government do something about it? And I should say the alternative view, which I perhaps used to feel more sympathetic to than I do now, is that it's up to people to choose how much they save and live with the consequences. Well, there are some weaknesses to that argument, as perhaps you'll be able to see. So the structure of the paper I want to present, I first of all want to look at the evidence for whether governments can influence national saving. Secondly, I want to set out what rather horribly economists call an overlapping generations framework to explain how transfers between different generations can take place and how they can be either intermediated through the public sector or arise as a consequence of people's choices, or indeed as a consequence of things happening in the marketplace. I want to say something about concepts of fairness between generations. I want to suggest some ways in which perhaps in the long term government policy might need to reflect some of these issues, and then I want to come to some conclusions. Now, as I was arguing that, pre-crisis, the argument was that fiscal policy shouldn't be used for short-term economic management. That was essentially up to the Bank of England. So now I suppose I'm 1/9 of that. But that governments should manage budgets with reference to an indicator of borrowing, and fashions changed a bit there. Under the previous Conservative government, it was public sector borrowing. It then became the government current account, i.e. the argument that it was okay to borrow to invest. But the second of Gordon Brown's golden rules was that you shouldn't let the government debt get too large, and it wasn't terribly clear where the notion of what was a reasonable government debt came from. But we have found that we have been able to live with rather larger government debts than he thought. Indeed, during the financial crisis, or as a result of the financial crisis, it's perfectly possible that the UK's national debt will get up to 90% of GDP, which incidentally is still a level below the average of where it's been in the 20th century, certainly, and I think since the Napoleonic Wars. From an economic point of view, there was also an argument which, in my view, had a surprising amount of currency, that essentially the private sector would just offset any fiscal deficit that the government ran. This is an old argument going back to David Ricardo, but I think the interest of it is not that it's a plausible thing to happen, but that if you look carefully at the conditions that are needed for it to happen, then you would think it most unlikely that it would be observed in practice. At least that's my view. People need all to have descendants. They all need to worry about their descendants. You have to not have anyone who would like to be able to borrow money but can't. And putting all those together, it seems to me a bit unlikely that you would actually observe that the private sector would unwind the effects of budget deficits or budget surpluses. Well, that's the background. The current debate has been a concern about government solvency, and I'm certainly not arguing that concerns about government solvency are an irrelevance. I'm not commenting on Britain's position, but certainly if you look at what happened in the Irish Republic and in Greece, you can certainly see that high levels of debt, of government debt, can incur can lead to all sorts of problems, difficulties in funding the debt, and then financial crises. And they may also lead to inflationary pressures if people conclude that, if governments conclude that when they've got large debts, unanticipated inflation is the way out of them. Well, that's the current debate, but as I say, I want to think about the longer term framework, the relationship between overall public debt and overall saving, and the need to consider fairness between generations. Well, what is the relationship between government saving and national saving? This chart shows the averages of the two, government saving and national saving, over the period 1978 to 2007. And there is the sort of econometrician's nightmare there. It looks like a strong statistical relationship, but that strong statistical relationship comes from two outliers. And back in the days when economists used to plot their data, we were taught to look out for outliers. If you look at the remainder of the OECD countries clustered round here, Well, it's rather obvious that the relationship is much weaker. I would also mention that on this chart, I couldn't find data for New Zealand, which is a low-saving country, or Greece, which has been a low-saving country, and the two lowest-saving countries in the OECD for which there were data happened to be the United Kingdom and the United States. So if I'm concerned with a low level of national saving, it can be seen, you know, in two ways, either in the abstract sense, whatever you're doing, perhaps you ought to think it's enough, you ought to worry about whether it's enough, but also in the practical sense, the United Kingdom and the United States for a long period have been saving appreciably less than some other countries. Is that something we ought to worry about? Is that something that we ought to think about putting right? So, as I say, it's a practical issue as well as a purely conceptual issue. Well, if I move on from these data to look at the relationship between them, if I leave out Norway and South Korea, I find that there's a statistically insignificant relationship between national saving and government saving, with a coefficient of about 0.5. But if I use the annual data over that period, I get the same relationship between government saving and national saving, and because there are many more observations, it does turn out to be statistically significant. So the implication is that national saving increases by about half of an increase in government saving, or conversely, if you get a 1% increase in government saving, the private sector reduces its saving by about half as much. In other words, people do react to the government as they see it, but the evidence, at least from these data, is certainly not that people are fully offset what the government does. Now, the framework, as I said earlier, in which I want to look at it is the overlapping generations model. No, I suppose in this context made popular by Peter Diamond, but originally developed by Maurice Allais in 1947. And what I want to do is to look at four ways of transferring resources between different generations. Well, some of them are perhaps more obvious as mechanisms than others. The national debt, is that a burden on our descendants or not? That's a question which had rather faded from view, but has come back recently, you know, and is quite widely discussed. There seems to be quite a bit of noise about it in the United States. The issue of pay-as-you-go benefits and pay-as-you-go financed government consumption. If you pay old age pensions and you pay for the health service, which accrues mainly to old people, out of general taxation, how different is that from running up a national debt? Then, another issue which is fairly obviously an intergenerational one, if people leave legacies to their descendants, it's a bit, or indeed to anyone else, anyone else's descendants, it's a bit hard to imagine that that is anything except a transfer between generations. And then the fourth item, I think, is in some ways the most interesting one. People are only now starting to realise that there's a substantial intergenerational transfer aspect to movements in, well, they typically say house prices, but I would rather focus on land prices. In other words, look at the land that was originally acquired for nothing, as it must have been, rather than the house that someone had to, pay for the bricks and mortar to build. So movements in land prices are a fourth item. And I want to do this making simplifying assumptions, the assumption of a constant population and the assumption of labour augmenting technology at a constant rate. Essentially, that means that each generation is 2% a year, no, that productivity grows at 2% a year. So if you have a generation every year, then each generation will be, I don't know, at a guess, 50% productive more than its parents, and that is something which just happens and we used to regard as manna from heaven. Now, if you will excuse a bit of algebra, please, which I hope won't look or won't be too alarming, the structure is that people have one unit of labour and they work when they're young, in period one, and they know that they only work when they're young. So the problem that they have to face is how much to consume when you're young and how much to consume when you're old. And no, I would now stress that people can make any decision that they like. I mean, one can produce models based on the rate of return which explain that decision, and I will do that at some point later on. But essentially, people can do anything that they want. They can consume what they like in each of those periods. But unless someone gives them a handout, the more you consume in the first period, the less you have to consume in the second period. And unless someone else offers you a handout, in other words, your children support you, then you might well find yourself, if you've gone on a binge when you're young, you might well find yourself consuming less than you had hoped for when you were old. In other words, you might be disappointed by the level of consumption that you had. But suppose you went on a binge when you were young and your children felt that they ought to bail you out, then you might feel fine, but it would be or could be your children who felt disappointed by the level of consumption they had had when young, because they would observe that, after adjusting for productivity growth, their spending hadn't risen relative to your own spending as much as they might have hoped. In other words, productivity, the amount they produce had gone up by, say, 50%, but because you'd gone on a binge when you were young and they'd had to bail you out in old age, their consumption was only 30% higher than yours had been. So, if you have people who go on a consumption binge when they're young, then it's likely either that they're going to be disappointed in their old age or someone else is going to be disappointed in their old age. And in neither of those cases would I say that the economy was operating on a sustainable path. I mean, it's sustainable in some sense. You can deliver it, but it's certainly not one that people are likely to feel particularly happy with. Well, for those of you who... Well, perhaps I should say those of you who are interested probably know the algebra behind this model without me reciting it. The point is that the capital stock is equal to the saving in the first period, and the capital stock then determines the level of output and thus the wage rate. So people's willingness to save up for the future influences the overall level of productivity in the economy. If you consume everything when you're young, you have less cooperating capital, and so you have smaller output than if you decide to save up for old age. That, as I say, isn't an argument to say you should save everything up for old age. There's no case for great privation now relative to great privation in the future, but what you have to do is strike a reasonable balance. Well, in that story, what sort of transfers might arise? And the most obvious one that one might think of is the national debt. And no, suppose we have people who didn't save up very much when they were young, but they have a really good idea, let's print some national debt certificates and sell them to our children. And no, those certificates, well, I was going to say, no, it could be national debt that goes on ever, forever, like war loan. Well, perhaps children would be a bit suspicious of something with a name like that, but you could imagine, no, national debt going on forever, that people print debt certificates, they sell them to their children are prepared to buy them because they know they'll be able to sell them to their children, and so on. And no, provided that the rate of interest is bigger than the rate of growth, which it normally is, I won't make any comment about today's somewhat anomalous circumstances, then what you can show is that the benefit that today's old people get from selling the debt certificates is exactly equal to the discounted value of the reduction in consumption that all future generations face. So this scheme of printing national debt certificates is a mechanism for transferring resources from future generations to the current generation, and that is essentially the mechanism that the people who are complaining that the national debt is a burden on the future are focusing on. So, no, seen in these terms, and I'm not saying that this model is a complete description of the world, I'm not saying as a consequence of this you would never want to run up national debt, but this does illustrate the mechanism whereby the national debt can be a burden on the future. Essentially, young people regard national debt certificates as a substitute for productive capital, because both of them can be used to pay for old age, but productive capital, increases the productivity of the economy, whereas beyond using the debt certificates to make lampshades or whatever, there isn't much you can do with them except pass them on to your own descendants. So, that's the mechanism by which national debt can crowd out productive capital. Well, another mechanism, which I do show is exactly equivalent, and I'm not claiming any originality for this to say the least, is to introduce pay-as-you-go transfers. So instead of old people printing debt certificates and selling them to their children, they say to their children, look, you give me some money. And their children may think, well, we can say the same to our children, and the amount of the transfer can grow in line with the productive potential of the economy. But at the end of the day, it's the first generation which has benefited from this, and everyone else finds that they're worse off as a result. And you can show that the transfer to received by old people is exactly equal to the discounted reduction in consumption of all future generations. So there's a one-for-one mapping, at least in this simple story, between pay-as-you-go transfers and the national debt. Well, you may well wonder, if that's the case, why do we get exercised about the level of the national debt and not get exercised about the intergenerational burden arising through this sort of mechanism? And I must say, I think that's a very good question. Or let me put the point another way round. Supposing, instead of regarding national insurance payments as a tax, which is the way they're treated at the moment, we regarded our own national insurance payments to the government as a loan from which the government would then pay our state benefits. You might think that that is perhaps a more accurate description, at least, of the basic insurance principle. And if that were the case, fairly obviously, the measured level of government debt would be quite a lot higher than it actually is. So the point I want to make is that at least in this framework, we have one mechanism, the national debt, which has a reputation as being a burden on future generations, and we have another mechanism, transfer payments from young people to old people, which we don't think of in the same way. But at least in this context, they are exactly equivalent. And over the last, 25 years or so, some economists have been arguing, I think with only partial success, that in government accounts, the national debt and the effects of these sorts of payments should be treated in much the same way. And I must say, I think it's an argument that I'm very sympathetic to. It would increase our understanding of what the government is actually doing in the economy. Well, the third thing I wanted to mention runs the other way round. Legacies can offset debt burdens that if people leave bequests to their children, then plainly, in an arithmetic sense, they can unwind the burden imposed by the national debt. And that's no great surprise. Of course, one of the things that we have to remember, which can rather get left out of this debate, is that not everyone has parents who can leave them a legacy. So, this is a mechanism which, seen in this simple aggregate model, looks as though it could work, but there would be substantial distributional impacts if you wanted to rely on legacies at a disaggregated level to unwind the effects of what one might describe as a rather profligate government. Now, the fourth mechanism that I want to discuss is land. And as I say, this I think is something that really hasn't received the attention it should have over a long period, although in the last couple of years, as young people have started to notice the burden on them imposed by rising land prices, they have perhaps become a bit more vocal about it. This, I should also say, links rather nicely into the environmental debate. When we hear discussions about protecting the environment, about preserving the environment for future generations, we tend to think of physical amenities. When we talk about depleting resource stocks, we tend to think of some mine which is getting exhausted. But actually, if you look at what had been happening to land prices over, say, the last 20 years, my guess is it's been a rather more efficient means of ruining future generations than the things that we have done to the physical environment. Well, those of you who are interested can look at the slides or the paper which came out in Oxrep in the spring of last year. But let me just go through in broad terms about how land plays this sort of role. Well, although we're all used to the idea of land being valuable and something that you have to pay for, of course, originally this blessed plot wasn't owned by anyone. And the history of how what initially must have been public land, because there wasn't anyone living here, was converted into private property isn't something that I'll go through. But it's all too easy to think of that as something that happened in, at least in economic terms, the relatively distant past. Actually, if you look at the value of the land, rather than the physical transfer of it from being public and common property to being private property, if you look at the value of the land, then it's as though most of the enclosure had happened really rather recently. The people who bought their house for £3,000 in 1950 and are now selling it for £2 million. Well, the fact, even inflation adjusted, that they paid £3,000 rather than just enclosing the land, appropriating it for nothing, is relatively unimportant in the calculation. So the sort of house price boom that we have had has meant that in economic terms, it's as though all these things we read about in history books, the feudal society, the enclosures and so on, actually it's as though they've happened in the last 50 or 60 years. And in that sense, it's a rather hot topic. Well, the model that I've set out is one where the price of land goes up because people just decide they want to spend more on land. And if you have land in fixed supply and the price of land and people decide they want to spend more on it, then the only way in which the market can be cleared is by the price of land going up. If the price of land goes up, then obviously the people who already own the land accrue capital gains, future generations are worse off, and you can go through exactly the sorts of calculations that I described earlier, showing that the transfer, the burden on future generations discounted is exactly equal to the gain made by current old people who happen to own the land. So in that sense, we can see the land as being much like the national debt. And indeed, some calculations I did a couple of years ago suggested that in terms of that sort of burden, the increase in land prices that we'd had since the mid-1980s was roughly like an increase in national debt of 100% of GDP. Obviously, this isn't the sort of thing that's going to lead to a solvency crisis, but I'm not talking about solvency crises. I'm talking about burdens on future generations. And while people have been making quite a lot of noise about protecting the environment, this sort of hidden burden from rising land prices had remained largely uncommented on. Well, let me skip through that and now say something briefly about concepts of fairness. Well, I can think of three concepts of fairness. One is that each generation should be expected to pay its own way. This is fair in some sense. You're not supporting anyone else. No one else is supporting you. And paying your own way, of course, includes doing things like leaving the natural environment in the shape in which you found it, or compensating future generations for any spoilation of the natural environment. That's one concept of fairness. A second concept of fairness, which is also valuable, is to think of a social planner who, someone who can look across generations and knows what's fair. So a sort of omniscient being that prescribes fairness. A third idea of fairness is that old people and young people alive at the same time have similar living standards. So although young people may be becoming more productive than old people, you nevertheless think it's not fair that young people should be much better off when young than their parents are when they are old, and you want to do something about that. Well, I think the idea that each generation should pay its own way, you may say, is right or not right, but it's a fairly basic notion of fairness. Of course, the argument the other way round is that because living standards are rising between generations, it's inherently unfair that each generation should be expected to pay its own way, and it's inherently fair that there should be transfers from future generations to the current generation. In other words, we should spend some of this increase in productivity, which I have assumed is going to come. Now, both of those are forms of fairness. Why do I prefer the argument that each generation should pay its own way to the argument that we should now draw on the future? Well, I suppose I came to that argument by thinking of the problem that a social planner would face. And suppose instead of thinking of the social planner as someone who balances off different generations, you think of the social planner as a single, infinitely lived consumer and ask the question, how would this infinitely lived consumer want to allocate their consumption over time? Well, as the economists present will know, the answer to that depends on the interest rate, the discount rate, and the degree of intertemporal substitution. And we know what sort of growth rate of consumption would that give you? Well, we know, roughly speaking, what the rate of return on capital is. In real terms, over a long period, it's about 4%. We know, or at least we hope we know, that the growth rate of the economy is something like 2%. There are arguments about what the intertemporal elasticity of substitution is, and we can make what we think are reasonable guesses about how people discount the future. And when you do all that, you can't produce a strong argument that the social planner would want to transfer resources between from future generations to people currently alive, or the other way round. Let me put the argument from a slightly different perspective. Looking at the way people spend money over their lifetimes, we do tend to observe that consumption tends to rise broadly in line with productivity. In other words, people's consumption over their lifetime does go up. It's not simply that their children consume more than they do. It does tend to increase, although you often find old people are poor relative to young people. Nevertheless, there is upward drift over people's lifetimes, and that's actually at a rate not terribly different from the rate of productivity growth. I mean, there are all sorts of questions how you disentangle that from the data that can reasonably be asked. But suppose that people do want their consumption to grow roughly in line with productivity over their own lifetimes, then it's a reasonable notion of fairness is to say you treat your future generation as though you were still alive at that time in the future. So if you want consumption to grow at 2% a year, maybe over the 60, 65, 70 years of your adult life, then a reasonable assumption is that you want that to be available to future generations, to the world that you would see were you still around in 200, 300 years. And if that is the case, then you actually come to the same notion of fairness as at the top, i.e. that each generation should pay its own way. What about similar living standards of young and old people? No, that sort of notion of fairness between generations. Well, no, it's a very valid one, but the point is that living standards can be equated by government action in a number of different ways. Indeed, we saw that in the examples I gave earlier. If old people were going to be poor in old age because they had spent a lot when young, the government could tax young people and transfer resources from future generations to current generations. Or equally, if it observed that people were spending a lot when they were young and were going to be poor in old age relative to the then youth, it could introduce some sort of effective compulsory savings scheme for them so that they weren't poor when they reached old age. Now, those are two different mechanisms of achieving this last notion of fairness. So even if you do think that this notion of fairness is important, you still have to ask yourself, should each generation pay its own way or not? And my own view for the arguments that I gave is, broadly speaking, that each generation should pay its own way. Well, of course, things can go wrong. You can have suppose you do have a generation which is profligate. what should be done about it? Well, you might say, you know, greater is the joy in the kingdom of heaven over one sinner who repenteth, that actually if there's a profligate generation, then future generations should pick up the bill. But of course, if you get a it's thought that that would happen, you might say it would encourage generations to be profligate, and you'd get back into the situation where, as a matter of course, children were making transfers to their parents. So, it's a difficult question what you do about, or what this social planner would do about people who chose not to save and don't like the consequences of not having saved. Perhaps that's a question I'd like to duck and simply say that I think the moves that we've seen recently towards increasing saving, making saving easier through the development of the Nest pension scheme, I think are very valuable, and I wouldn't be terribly surprised if over the next 20 years or so that sort of scheme does expand. So at the very least, one ought to think of policy as making it easy for people to save. But rather than get on to number five, if I skip through to summary and conclusions, since time is running out, fiscal policy does need to balance present and future consumption, and that does mean that if you have the sort of population bulge that we have now, which is likely to lead to high future consumption, then you should be thinking, the government should be thinking of saving to pay up for old age, and national saving should be high at times when you have a high working population that needs to save up for its retirement. I think that transfers between generations are really rather hard to justify. Of course, once you've started making transfers, the question how you get out of them is rather difficult. But certainly, I think it's unfortunate that they developed in the way that they did, and at a time when they really seemed rather affordable, because focus was on the conventional measures of government borrowing rather than on measures that took account of long-term commitment. I think that if people do have a tendency to be myopic, not to think enough about the future, then the government does have a role in offsetting that. In other words, if people are going to be disappointed by their circumstances when they reach old age, then the government should do something and can do something to protect themselves from that. One issue I haven't said very much about, governments plainly do also have a role in precautionary saving. We know all too well that things can go wrong with the economy, and it's sensible to have saved up for those in advance. We don't know when things are going to go wrong, but you can be completely sure that the sort of problems we've had over the last 3 years won't be the last time that something like that happens. Finally, I would mention that rising land prices do increase the burden on future generations. Well, ministers have recently said that we need to change our attitudes to housing, that housing shouldn't be seen as a sort of speculation. That is quite right. On the other hand, of course, one can think of a range of policies that might be needed so as to ensure that housing is a way of providing somewhere to live, and we don't have this transfer mechanism continuing in the future. So taking all these together, I suppose what I'm saying is that national saving does matter. We do have to think about saving if we want the economy to operate on a sustainable basis. I would like to see discussion of saving play a greater role in the macroeconomic debate than it has over the last 30 years, but certainly also we shouldn't think that if aggregate saving is okay, then there's nothing else that can go wrong. Having a sustainable level of saving, an adequate level of aggregate saving, won't in itself protect you from the sort of crisis that we've seen recently. Thank you very much.